Hello, hello, hello. How's everyone feeling this afternoon? Yeah, Aspen Ideas Conference, thank you for having me. My name is Chuteska Martinez. I'm a 17-year-old climate activist, indigenous rights activist, spokesperson for the younger generation, a plaintiff in a lawsuit against the federal government and the Trump administration for violating our constitutional rights to a healthy and stable climate. I believe that climate change is one of the defining issues of our time. I believe that it is bigger than politics, bigger than the economy, bigger than the environment, bigger than one individual or one corporation or a political party, because as an issue that connects each and every one of us, we all have a responsibility to do something, to fight for change, to fight for justice, and to use the influence that we have to bring our sectors in on this conversation of how are we going to leave the future generations a safer, more healthy, habitable planet. The future of our economies, of our environment, and the legacy that we leave to the next generation depends on the action that we take today to address the climate crisis. And I believe that there is no greater time than now to be alive. I believe that there is no greater time than now to address the greatest issue of our time, to bring together humanity in a way we have never seen before. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm John Dickerson of CBS, and I'm here with Governor Hickenlooper of Colorado. Yeah, exactly. So, Governor, I want to start. Yesterday, you were in Washington. What were you doing?
So, I was in Washington with Governor John Kasich from Ohio. And we thought for the last 2.5 months, we've been working on with some Republican governors and some Democratic governors to begin to look at what a bipartisan approach to reforming Obamacare would look like. So yesterday was we went out Monday night and Tuesday morning we went to the National Press Club. And we basically just did he spoke for 5 minutes and I spoke for 5 minutes, and then we answered questions about what was the House healthcare plan, what was the Senate healthcare plan really trying to get to, and was it an improvement of our nation's healthcare system in any way? And I think we both felt strongly from a bipartisan perspective that the suggestions really were largely driven by politics and political promises, and that in the end, you were looking at a massive tax cut between corporations, you know, individuals, something like Rough Justice, $230 billion over 10 years, corporations and other recipients, well over $400 billion. A tax cut that, at least in my experience, most wealthy people don't need, aren't fighting for, and in that circumstance are being portrayed as bad people, I think unfairly. And there's no improvement to you're going to see the Congressional Budget Office estimated that there would be 22 million people that would lose coverage. And so in Colorado, that's that works out to about 200,000 or 220,000 people. And it's, you know, the stories are very tough. So Kasich and I were trying to show, and we believe that governors who work together on a bipartisan basis all the time, it's part of our DNA, that really what ought to happen is they should start over, get some Republicans and Democrats. I mean, nothing good happens when it's in secret and one party does it. And I say that about any part, either party. Start over with a blank slate and get Republicans and Democrats, senators and governors. Because governors are the ones who have to implement this stuff. Might as well have us in the process and see if we can do a better job. Give us 8 months and see if we can figure it out.
In parenting, they call this, I think, modeling. Are you trying to send a message to Washington about what this looks like for a Democrat and we'll get to the policy in a second. But just a Republican and a Democrat and Republicans and Democrats working together is part of your message that reminding Washington of how to do that?
Yeah, I guess part of this, and Kasich is a perfect balance for me. I'm a Democrat, but I'm really pretty moderate. I'm socially liberal, but fiscally moderate. And Kasich is pretty conservative, but he's also moderate on all social issues and in certain financial issues. And he has been outspoken from the beginning that we should not roll back the coverage of people that, you know, are facing the greatest challenges in our society. And I think having a Republican and a Democrat both say that is a loud statement.
How does that conversation start? I mean, you were in Washington yesterday, but when does it start? How does it start? Months ago? What was the initiating event that created this collaboration that now has seemed to have paid off, at least in the delay of the Senate health care bill?
So I had met with a couple of Republican governors and several Democratic governors at the National Governors Association meeting in Washington the end of January. I think it was the end of January. And there were a number of Republican governors who, Rick Snyder in Michigan, Charlie Baker in Massachusetts, a bunch, that had real concerns with the proposed health care plans, certainly with the one then coming out of the House. And so I was trying to convince them that they should go public with this, because in most of those states, there's a senator, a Republican senator, who's also somewhat moderate and there is, was having, would be having second thoughts. So we looked at that, and then Kasich came out. He was not at that conference. But Brian Sandoval, the governor of Nevada, and one of the great governors in America, I think, you know, he's worth looking. If you're interested in seeing someone who's really governing the way states deserve to be governed, Brian Sandoval's one of those people. He called me and said he'd been talking to Kasich, and then I needed to talk to Kasich. And so then Kasich and I agreed that we would put together a letter with four basic proposals, kind of core values, to Mitch McConnell in the Senate, and, you know, kind of lay out a framework by which we thought they could, you know, do a better job.
And where does this thing stand now? The Senate bill has been delayed, but in terms of your project, where does it, what's next?
So now we're working on still more governors, and the governors are working on still more senators. And my guess, you know, once they've delayed it, I think those senators are going to go home and really hear the unhappiness of the public about rolling back 22 million people off of health care. I mean, when you actually get into the weeds and see what the consequences are to people's lives, it is really disturbing. So they're going to hear those stories, and I think what will happen is I hope their senators, like Tom Carper of Delaware, reached out to me and said, hey, if this is really something that could happen, I'd like to work on that. I haven't talked to him yet, but that was the indirect message I got. And, you know, I think there are a number. I think our Senator Michael Bennett would be a perfect person to work on something like that with some Republicans. And then, you know, they're going to be, I mean, this is, A, healthcare is incredibly complex. B, there are huge numbers involved. And C, they're really difficult trade-offs. But that's what it's about, right? But you can't just try and do it all in one way and muscle it through.
All right, I want to switch to the economy now. What's the most exciting thing happening in your state right now on the economy?
You know, the thing that everyone talks about is a month and a half ago, our unemployment came down to 2.3%, which is the lowest unemployment in the United States. There are only four other states in the history of measuring unemployment that have ever been that low. And we've now been 2 months. So that's what people talk about. But I'm not sure that's the most exciting thing. I think, you know, I think we've worked for the last 6 years to cut red tape and bureaucracy to provide an ecosystem where entrepreneurs are not just accommodated, but they are welcomed and you know, we're actively trying to figure out how to get more access to capital, how to have a peer-to-peer learning for startups. We probably have one of the top two or three startup environments in the country. I mean, I think that's what we're seeing. We tried to make the whole Front Range, the whole state, a place that welcomes young people. There are more live music venues in Denver now than there are in Nashville or Austin. Fact. You go look at some of the big rock and roll bands out now, the Lumineers, the Fray, Nathaniel Rateliff and the Night Sweats, One Republic. Those are all Denver bands, right? And we haven't really talked about it. We also now in Metro Denver have over 1,000 miles of bike trails. In the state, we're well over 20,000 miles, and we have a mapping program that we'll roll out this summer where they'll all be on a handheld, and people will be able to file photographs and audio files and text files where they're hiking. So it's all cloud-based, so they'll be able to go back and look at the pictures 20 years later.
So clearly you're making the quality of life pitch.
And that, I think what's exciting is that pitch works. In other words, being a magnet for creative young talent is a big part of why we have all these tech companies opening up in Colorado and why we've got a diversified, I mean, we really do have the most diversified economy in the state's history.
What comes first, the bright, smart college graduates who want to have the GPS tell them where they biked and hiked, and then that money comes because, oh my gosh, this incredibly smart person now lives in Denver, or is the other way around? They only will come to Denver because they know that somehow it's beaten out Boston, San Francisco, and New York for some of that money.
I think that money follows talent in this world. And the big reason why, and once you create that feedback loop, once you are a magnet for talent and you have the best talent, that's where the money goes. Now, where the money is generally where the best talent wants to go. So Silicon Valley, for the last couple decades, has had, without question, the highest concentration of the greatest and most innovative tech minds in the world. Boston, New York, San Francisco, Los Angeles, sure, Seattle. Denver would be that top of that second tier. I think that now can change, and that's what we're trying to readjust some of those coordinates.
So not everybody is an entrepreneur in Colorado. To have an unemployment rate that's that low, there's other kinds of people working. Give me the tiers of the quality of work, and how are you helping people train for the next level and next kind of jobs?
So that's the big question, and that's the thing that I think is the most exciting thing I've been involved with in my 15 years of public service. That we've got two programs, and we were just starting them. I talked a little bit about them last year. One is CareerWise, which is an apprenticeship program modeled on the Swiss and German models, which is not just for electricians and plumbers, it's for banks and insurance companies, advanced manufacturing, aerospace. And it's based on that notion that kids, and we're doing a pilot this year, and we're gonna have thousands of kids next year. Hopefully in 10 years we'll have 20,000 kids in this. But it allows kids who, instead of going to their junior year of high school, they go to work. And they work 3 days a week, and the 2 days, they'll go back to a community college or a workforce training center. And the curriculum of what they study will be designed by the industry in which they work. So if they're working in an insurance company, they'll be learning stuff that's relevant to their job in the insurance company. Kids love this. The pilot we're doing this year, kids love it, the businesses love it.
Now tell me about that, because sometimes businesses are nervous about apprenticeships because they put all this money into training these younger people, and then the younger people go, thanks, and they go off to somewhere else. And they've spent all this investment training them, but they've left. Is there a way to balance that out with tax credits or some kind of way with business?
Yeah, so in a funny way, it is a cost shift from government to the business community. But it's a cost shift that the business community wants. So we spend in Colorado, we're a low tax state. I'm embarrassed by this, but we spend about $8,000 per year for each kid. What happens is when they become an apprentice, that $8,000 is sitting there. We're not spending it at the school. So then we can give, let's say we give a $2,000 tax credit to the company. We can give a $2,000 stipend to do the research to make sure what we're teaching the kid really matters and is relevant to the industry in which they're working. And then we can give $2 million to counseling and mentoring all these kids, because that's a huge part of the success of this. And then we give $2,000 to the high school, just so they won't stab us in the back.
Right.
Well, there's got to be a little vigorous for everyone, or it's not going to really, you won't ever get it to really go to scale.
Now, what about I'm mid-career, or I trained in one thing and that no longer gets made anymore? What about the person who's, you know, younger, older than the person you're talking about?
So that's the second part of this. The career, and career-wise, just to finish the answer to the previous question, which I managed to bridge over, most businesses look at these apprenticeships as a much, they believe that there'll be a much higher percentage of the kids that come through an apprenticeship will stay than those people they just hire through the want ads.
Okay.
So that's why there's a little bit of stickiness there. Now, those older people that, or even kids but of all ages who aren't going to go to college, I mean, you got to realize that, you know, 70% of our kids are never going to get a four-year college degree or even a two-year college degree yet. And for the last 20 or 30 years, we've done a very poor job of training them for meaningful jobs. And for that reason, we have huge gaps. So we've been working for the last 2.5 years with the Markle Foundation. Zoe Baird kind of started this about 4 years ago. And we've been their kind of test case, where we call it the LinkedIn. LinkedIn has partnered with Markle to create this platform called Skillful. And instead of talking about degrees, we're talking about skills. And kids look at it, here are the skills I get from each of these classes, and every job I have, I get these skills. And to get to this next job, what are the skills I need in the middle? Or if my profession gets wiped out by technology or automation, if those jobs go away, here are the skills I have. What are the other emerging jobs that I might apply for? And what are the skills I need to add? And my favorite example is, and there are many, many examples, but bank tellers. We have 4 banks now that are converting to robots instead of bank tellers. There's several banks that have no bank tellers in them at all. It's all automatic. What do the skills of bank tellers, what do bank tellers have? They're numerate, high sense of precision. They are collaborative. They have a high sense of urgency. Well, look at some of the job openings. We have a lot of cybersecurity in Colorado, 9,000 job openings, more than half don't need a college degree. What are the skills? Well, they've got to be numerate, high sense of precision, sense of urgency, collaborative. Now, the bank teller would probably have to take, you know, a 6-month class on not how to write code, but how to put code together. But if they took that class, they could probably move right into one of those cybersecurity jobs, get a $10,000 raise, still get, you know, health care. I mean, it's one of those things where, and I think as a society, this is why I think it's so important, we've got to look at that whole range of a person's life and that they are constantly responsible themselves for their assembly of skills and how that's going to prepare them and help them in jobs.
Just got 4 minutes left, so I'm going to...
Wait, one other thing?
Yeah.
This once we really scale this, and yesterday we got a $25 million grant from Microsoft, the largest philanthropic grant that they have ever given for this skillful platform, this ecosystem around skills. And once we get it, part of that money is being used to so that we can show this and help share this idea with other states. Once we really scale it up, I don't know how many of you ever have heard the soundtrack to Hamilton. Do you know there's that song, I'm not throwing away my shot, shot, I'm not throwing away my shot, shot. I went online 12 and a half months ago, and I own myshot.com, myshot.org, myshot.co. So once we get this together, Lin Miranda doesn't know this yet, so don't tell him. But we're going to convince him to write special lyrics and let us use that song, and we're going to call the whole program My Shot, because we're really giving these kids their shot.
And he plays the banjo. Let me ask you about immigration quickly, because this is obviously a big national issue. And tell us the Colorado story in terms of deportation, immigration, what's happening at the state level as you see it.
I think we're like a lot of states. We have had a high level of immigration for many years. Most states that have strong economies have remarkably diverse populations and have had huge amounts of immigration. Walk through the streets of Boston or Seattle or San Francisco, New York. Our success to a large extent happens from that diversity of ideas and of skills and training. And I think, you know, we have been very clear, we're not going to use any of our resources to try and deport people that haven't created, you know, trouble, that haven't, aren't involved in gangs or violent crime, criminal behavior somewhere. And, I've met with Attorney General Sessions a couple months ago. And you can imagine the two things we talked about: immigration, pot, immigration. But in both cases, he was pretty, I mean, the man is a very conservative man. He made no bones. He thinks more people doing drugs in the United States, the worse it is for the country. He makes no bones. He's not going to do anything that would even remotely suggest to someone that it would be a good idea to, or a safe thing to do, to open a, start growing pot or open a shop or, you know, to get involved in illegal immigration. That being said, he understands the bigger problem, that really the violent criminals who are here illegally, it's going to take up all their time, and they're going to focus on that. And the same thing with marijuana, heroin, meth, amphetamine, all that stuff, that's going to take the focus.
So he's going to leave you alone?
I wouldn't say that. I'd say that it's, he knows what's going on. This is not, it's a little bit like with other families, not my childhood, but other families, if the kid, the parents are downstairs, they can smell something coming from upstairs, and they agree, you know, there's just an awkward relationship, and no one talks about it. I think that's what we're moving towards.
Yes. Okay. All right. I guess strategic ambiguity. So let me ask you, in the last 30 seconds we have left, a political question. Why are you a Democrat?
So, and this is true, my mother was the oldest of five daughters in Philadelphia, and all four of her sisters were Republicans. Both her parents were Republicans. She married my father, who was a Republican. He was the youngest of three boys from Cincinnati. Both his parents were Republicans. But my mother was widowed twice. She had two children with her first husband, who died at the end of World War II. And she met my dad, had two more kids, and then he died when I was eight. And my mother believed that government should be smaller, government should do more, but she believed in government. And she didn't believe that her siblings and their spouses really did believe in government enough. So my mother raised four Democrats.
And so then, just as a final question, the Democratic Party seems to be in a bit of a searching mode. What is your message to the larger Democratic Party? You have some interesting politics in Colorado. It's kind of one-third Democrats, Republicans, and independents. But what is your message to the bigger Democratic Party?
So the Democrats, we're already at work. I mean, we're really still trying to figure out how we lost 2016, and we really got to refocus our attention on how we're going to lose 2020. It's a joke. That's a joke. Yeah. I see a lot of startled faces out there. I think the Democratic Party is always going to be the party of civil rights and social justice. It's going to be, you know, the party that sticks up for everybody. But I think that the party needs to emphasize more that jobs matter, and you know, how we get and create environments where our kids are going to get better choices, and kids who grow up in really low-income neighborhoods should have the same opportunity and the same choices as every other kid. I think that economically oriented discussion has got to be a bigger part of the Democratic, you know, what we talk about.
All right, Governor Hickenlooper, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you all.
Hi, everybody. Welcome. Wow. A little louder than I thought. I'm Andrea Mitchell from NBC News and MSNBC, and it is such a great pleasure to be here. Thank you to the Aspen Institute and Aspen Ideas to be here having this conversation with one of my heroes, Ambassador Samantha Power. Our former Ambassador to the United Nations, a Pulitzer Prize winner for for her landmark book, A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide, which also won the National Book Critics Award. After her extraordinary reportage on the Bosnia War, now on the joint faculty of the Harvard Law School and the Kennedy School at Harvard, she is very busy writing her memoir entitled The Education of an Idealist, which I think is a great note on which to begin. Tell me, what is the education of an idealist, and how would you define idealist? Because we need a little more idealism, I think, these days.
We do. Well, first, thank you for being here. Thank you all for staying in this hot tent. Thank you, Walter, for your decades of leadership and your humanity, which just oozes through every pore and every one of these sessions. I guess, first of all, I should say that I've never used the first person in my writing at all, and in therapy even have trouble using the first person. So the thought of writing anything personal in a memoir is anathema, and this is why I'm in Aspen instead of at my computer. But the arc, I guess, of having been an outside critic of U.S. foreign policy and then going into the room where it happens, you know, went from being in the room and literally experiencing the equivalent of an intruder alert in my brain, feeling as if I didn't belong there because I'd spent so many years, like you, interviewing people to try to find out what these discussions were like. And then, of course, having to defend policies that sometimes weren't my favorite, defending things I very much believed in, like our leadership on Ebola, on ISIL, other things. But I think when you hear the education of an idealist, it's a little misleading. There's the old expression, a conservative is a liberal who's been mugged by reality. That is not my experience of government. I left government wiser, certainly, more alert, I think, to the form that the constraints took. But I went into government very aware that one is constrained in trying to alleviate human suffering abroad. So I'd say just a few of the lessons. I mean, I think what I would have underestimated before was bandwidth as a problem. I mean, when we went all in on securing the Iran nuclear deal, there was a real effect of that diplomatic bandwidth getting gobbled up over so many months on our ability to sit on the Syria problem. It just is the case that there was one Secretary of State. And I would stress that, you know, I think the current administration, the indispensability of filling these diplomatic posts, you know, on paper it's an issue to have so many vacancies. But when you think about your inability to put high-level people who can actually convene high-level people from other countries who can actually make decisions, there's just practical reasons to get these positions filled so you can task people. I think human dignity is totally underestimated, and national dignity is underestimated as a force in foreign policy. The mileage and the points I got for such little gestures when I was ambassador to the UN, like I decided I was going to visit every one of the other 192 missions of the UN, and in showing up, I'd say 50, 60 of them were missions that had never been visited by the American ambassador in the history of the United Nations or in the history of a small country. When I then go to that country and ask them to stand with us in rejecting Russia's annexation of Crimea, they remember, Central African Republic remembers, you know, that the American ambassador showed up. This is not broadly known, but I will confess it here. I was in a band while I was at the UN called UN Rocks. And the Korean was the drummer, the Korean ambassador. The Togolese ambassador played the keyboard. And the Thai, the Serb, and the Papua New Guinean also played guitars. And the Danish ambassador played guitars. God, he'd kill me. Electric guitar and bass. And I was the lead singer. Now, my voice didn't sound like it sounded today, but it didn't sound much better. So if you want a testament to American soft power, it is that we have so much power that they would tolerate a lead singer like me just to have America in the band. But in doing that and in being prepared to be vulnerable and sort of occasionally humiliate myself, I think then again, when you show up and you want help on LGBT rights, which had no business making progress at the UN, given how many countries have retrograde laws, you know, criminalizing homosexuality, you had countries who wanted to do what we wanted. You know, it didn't mean they could, but they were going to look with me to figure out what kind of procedural loophole could we find that would allow them to find some other way to justify doing a progressive thing that wasn't about changing their country's laws back home, which they were not empowered to do. So dignity, 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 and bandwidth, and the importance of not overestimating America's leverage, right, which some do, I think thinking you just snap your fingers and if we only wanted it more, there'd be a serious solution. But also what I think is more pervasive is underestimating the leverage we have. Because when we put our minds to it, and I saw it at the UN just time and again when I was empowered to go forth and mobilize countries, I saw it in every Security Council meeting on everything from Burundi to North Korea, that, you know, other ambassadors would leave after I would speak. They just wanted to report to their capital what the United States' position was on a given day. So I learned a lot. I certainly learned about humility also in tackling a lot of these crises, but I feel much more idealistic on the back end of 8 long years in government than I even did going in.
I was very struck by the personal touch to your diplomacy. Reading about how you reacted when Vitaly Churkin, the Russian ambassador to the UN, died suddenly, and you paid tribute to him as my friend Vitaly, a diplomatic maestro, for which you were slammed on Twitter, because he's
shocking.
Russian, shocking. Tell me about friendships across those divides.
Well, I mean, I think it is surprising to people, given the clashes that I had with the Russian ambassador, which were not only very heated, not only very visible, not only very venomous at times, but they were completely heartfelt in the sense that they were about Aleppo. They were about Ukraine and, you know, lopping off part of a neighbor. So it is surprising to people that he was not only my closest colleague, but my closest friend as ambassador to the UN. He's the only ambassador I brought to my parents' home for Thanksgiving, as one example. He and his wife were friends with my husband, Cass, and myself. And he had a depth of character that I was able to see, notwithstanding the fact that he was Vladimir Putin's representative at the United Nations. I think if he was merely funny and soulful and, you know, culturally curious and, you know, a lot of things you'd like in a friend, but still was articulating these reprehensible positions, I don't think I could have had the kind of friendship I had in the period that we coincided in New York. Maybe in the 90s, you know, there wasn't that much friction in the relationship. But I think what made it possible was, after so many of our heated Security Council clashes, sometimes I'd have to cool off, being Irish, you know, for a day or two, but I would reach out to him and we would together try to get named Syrian political prisoners out of Assad's jails. Or we work together, of course, on the chemical weapons destruction effort, something he was very proud of. He was horrified by the use of chlorine, which was Assad's first example of trying to, you know, continue to use chemical weapons, basically. And we came up with an investigative mechanism. Weirdly, there was a gap in the international system that there was no body tasked with looking into who used chemical weapons. It's kind of crazy. So he and I together invented that at the Security Council, in the hopes that it would be a deterrent. He never admitted that Assad's government used chemical weapons. It was maddening, but we built the mechanism. Whether it had a footstep effect, I think, you know, different people, and a deterrent effect, people can disagree, but I think certainly chlorine use dropped pretty precipitously, and then, of course, started to tick back up when people realized there'd be no consequences. But the point is, he always was willing to try, even if we couldn't solve the entire problem. And Syria was certainly bigger than he or I, and our leaders had their own views. Could we hive off part of the problem? Could we get more food to besieged areas? Like that animated him. And with that, plus just, you know, human chemistry, I think we were able to sort of wring some water out of the stone, if I can put it that way. And it's very modest compared to the calamity and catastrophe that is Syria. But if he hadn't been in New York, and maybe you know, I don't know if other American ambassadors would have approached things the same way. I mean, you have to hold your nose, you know, to do that kind of diplomacy. But if he hadn't been there, if he had quit, right, which is what probably going into my job I would have wished he would have done, right, you know, to show Putin, then, you know, we wouldn't have created the things that we created together. Maybe we wouldn't have the North Korea sanctions package that we were able to pass, the toughest piece package of sanctions that I negotiated. It was the toughest in you know, 20-something years coming out of the UN. He could become an advocate for things that we secured in New York back to Moscow, and that was really important. So I think, you know, the cause of peace and security, weirdly, will miss a person who was the face of, frankly, trampling peace and security. But that's life. It's complicated. Very complicated.
You speak of Syria. I was going to ask you about highs and lows. I suspect that the low would be the Syrian conflict. If there's criticism about a lack of process now in the national security team, there is criticism of the Obama team for being perhaps too legalistic and too bureaucratic.
Respond. I think that it mattered greatly to President Obama whether we had an international legal basis to use military force. It mattered when we used drones against terrorist targets, and we developed an elaborate legal rationale. And it mattered when we were about to use force against the Assad regime. We came out and articulated what you might call an untraditional international legal basis, invoking the Chemical Weapons Convention and so forth. But the problem with law in the era of Vladimir Putin is that international law turns on being able to get Security Council authorization for the use of force, or for you to use force in self-defense, which is largely unobjectionable. And Vladimir Putin is himself trampling international law around the world and not likely to provide the United States with authorization to stop him or his proxies from doing so. So that's a structural tension that we ran into head on when we were prepared to use force initially, after the chemical weapons use in August 2013. So I think that this is a major problem, a structural deformity in international law today, that Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin, maybe you could even say, others certainly would say Donald Trump, are the arbiters of what's legal. That's an issue. And so I think it's fair to ask whether or not, you know, our administration's respect for adherence to, faithfulness to international law, or attempt to be faithful to it, is anachronistic in light of the rise of Putin and how international law gets defined. I think that what breaks my heart about Syria, in addition to just every day, any story you read about a Syrian family, is what I think the New York Times recently described as the Syrianization of the world, right? I mean, you know, we'll never know, but had we found a way, and I have no, you know, I had no silver bullet throughout. President Obama was always very eager to hear solutions that sounded credible and executable, and where it felt as though the benefits would outweigh the cost of the particular tool in play. And nothing we argued about or lobbied for ever crossed that threshold for him beyond the things that you've seen us do. But what's crushing is to look and see how having now 66 million displaced people in the world, a third of whom are Syrian, how that affected the British decision-making on Brexit. You know, how fear of refugees may even have been a factor in our election, in the sense of two viewpoints, in the sense of the kind of horde of uncontrollable migration happening, not only, of course, from Syria, but also from North Africa and elsewhere. So I think it's hard to say that the Syria issue has not played a major role in the resurgence of terrorism and ISIL, the heartbreak of millions of families, and more sort of psychic numbing around humanitarian suffering than we had experienced, you know, in many, I think, generations. I mean, Rwanda was the last kind of calamity of this magnitude, but it was over in 100 days. We're also used to seeing barrel bombs and chemical weapons use and refugee flow, and that dulls the senses and our expectations for how we treat one another and how we act as a great nation. So I think the costs are going to be felt for a long time to come. That doesn't therefore follow, as some would argue, that, you know, had we just followed Samantha's three-point plan or John McCain's three-point plan, you know, that we'd be in a different place. We could be in exactly the same place but bogged down with ground troops and God knows what else. But it's hard to imagine a worse set of consequences than where we are today.
And when we talk about the refugees in the camps, primarily in Jordan and Turkey and neighboring countries, there is such an elaborate interviewing process by the UNHCR. I just want to put that out there, because it's not as though these Syrian refugees, which, as I read the Supreme Court's recent decision, these are the people who will have no relationships, no school applications. They will have no jobs waiting for them, so none of these people will have any entry opportunities under this at least 90-day period. But the vetting that goes on is more than extreme. It's 18 months to 2 years.
Yeah, I mean, I was intimately involved in actually revamping the vetting in our first term with a desire to really ratchet it up. We made a commitment in the campaign to let in far more Iraqi refugees than the Bush administration had done. We felt we had a responsibility, even though it wasn't a war that we had prosecuted in the first instance. And we got our numbers way up to 25,000 Iraqis a year, but not before really trying to iron out, you know, any of the gaps that one could find. And, you know, our vetting process, it's UNHCR does its thing, but we would never rely on the UN, you know, as our security guardians. We have a process that's the counterterrorism center, the FBI, the CIA, any NSA data, you know, in terms of phone connections between potential refugees, you know, any fib, you know, even one that is related to health or how long you lived in a place, you're done, you're out, you know, and we have a lot of means for double checking and triple checking. So it's no accident that our process for letting a refugee into this country, the process to get clearance, takes nearly 36 months. And that's torture, as you can imagine, for a refugee family that's lying in wait, not knowing how their status is going to be adjudicated. But it is what has left us feeling very secure, left us, the prior administration, I should say, representing to the American people that we can achieve both our objectives at once, our first and foremost objective of keeping the American people safe, but also leading the world in taking our share of what is the largest refugee burden since World War II. And when we shrivel up and try to build walls and shut this program down, specifically for Syrian refugees or for Muslim refugees fleeing present-day nightmarish situations, all that does is give every other country with risk-averse pockets of their population or even majorities or pluralities of their population the excuse to do the same. So we're leading, even when we're, you know, you could say we're not leading on refugees anymore. No, we're leading. Believe me, we're leading. And you will see a cascade in terms of people using this as a justification. You know, America, we're going to lead for the time, but, you know, for the next decade, no matter how we choose to use that leadership. And this is an example of using it in a manner that is going to have exponential effects on the number of Syrians that can be resettled. But if I may just, what we don't do when we apply, let's call it the precautionary principle, you know, of trying to basically guarantee no risk whatsoever, because you can never eliminate risk if you're letting, you know, anybody in from any country. So if we apply the precautionary principle, try to eliminate risk, what we don't factor into that is what is the risk of letting these, you know, again, an exponential number of Syrian refugees remain inside Syria, potentially getting radicalized, or overburdening Jordan, Lebanon, countries whose stability really matters to us, Turkey, you know, which have been so generous for so long and now is, in certain parts of the border areas, shooting people who are coming across the border because they have no outlet strategy, they have no place then for these refugees to move on to. So what are the costs to our interests of the radicalization and the instability and the extremism that gets brewed by there being no outlet? I mean, and that has to be part of our calculus. And that's why you see people in the military, you know, kind of mumbling about the executive order and behind the scenes being very open that they think it's you know, bad for our national security, all things considered. But in a soundbite, if it's just a question, thumbs up, thumbs down, you know, do you want to keep a certain population out? People are like, well, maybe just keep them out just to be safe. But then they don't think about, are we making ourselves less safe over time in light of what we're, you know, what we're doing in the region and what we show of ourselves to the world?
There's been a definite de-emphasis on human rights and gender rights.
Not in the Cuba speech. Not in the Cuba speech. Suddenly, it was all about human rights.
which in other aspects of our foreign policy,
yeah,
when it comes to China and other countries. And in a major speech to the workforce at the State Department, Secretary Tillerson said, if we condition too heavily that others must adopt this value that we've come to after a long history of our own, it really creates obstacles to our ability to advance our national security interests, our economic interests. To which you tweeted at the time, brutal thugs are smiling, human rights are not only US values, they are universal. What is the impact of de-emphasizing human rights in our foreign policy?
Well, first let me say that there are a set of very fair questions to ask about how you balance a range of equities in any given day of foreign policy or any given encounter. And it's hard. I mean, you know, talking to an African leader about LGBT rights is no fun for our ambassadors around the world. Like, that's not their favorite thing to go and do, even if they believe they should, because, you know, criminalizing same-sex relationships is cruel and inhumane and in violation of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Similarly, talking to the Saudi ambassador about women's rights and, you know, voting and driving and is no fun, and it's something they're likely not to heed in any immediate sense. But it is the case that our soft power has derived from many things, including, you know, Broadway musicals like Hamilton and our culture and our sports and all the rest. But it also has derived from peoples around the world, not governments. We're never thrilled about this. I mean, even on the refugee and migration stuff, we had to talk to European governments about closing their borders to the flow of people. So even raising human rights with your closest allies who share your values is not fun and not necessarily impactful in the moment. But it is a part of what people who are oppressed or who just don't feel their voices are being heard, what they have counted on the United States for doing. And they've even counted on us doing it in hypocritical ways. I mean, no one has ever been perfect in the way that they have chosen to preach the gospel of human rights who's led the United States. We weren't, you know, certainly we're seeing a very different version of it in this administration. So this administration is saying, in a way, like, hey, we're going to be more honest, right? We're going to just say that we're de-emphasizing it and it's not going to be a factor. But they are going further than that in embracing people like Duterte, you know, in the Philippines, who is open about using force against, you know, people he says are drug users or involved in the drug trade, but who have no due process and are just being mowed down in the streets. He has been open in the past, not so much recently, about his affection for, respect for Vladimir Putin. So that's not merely, you know, choosing to balance the variables in a different way. And yet, one can be struck that when we intervened in Syria after the chemical weapons attack and bombed, you know, facilities involved in murdering civilians, that the language was the language of human rights and about children who shouldn't be killed by their government. When we tried to reverse some of the steps on the Cuba normalization process that we had unleashed, again, last week or whenever that was, the language was all about human rights in Cuba. And what won't work is to give speeches about de-emphasizing and other speeches about embracing, you know, bloody leaders and then turning around and invoking human rights. I mean, that just, even by the standards of, what is it, the tribute that Vice plays, or what is the thing about hypocrisy? Anyway, you know, that we nobody has been perfect in being fully consistent on human rights, and we weren't either. But there's a way of doing it now where it's so clear that this has been put to one side, and, you know, people could get used to that. It would be a great shame for all those people out there who count on us, but they could get used to that. But what they will never get used to is overtly de-emphasizing it or saying it doesn't matter and then turning around and invoking it as your rationale. That can't work.
And you've paid a great deal of attention to cultural diplomacy. As being in New York, you took other ambassadors to see Hamilton and other Broadway shows. You made great use of this. It strikes me that there are cultural treasures in our country. Big thinkers, big authors, people who have written about Ben Franklin, Albert Einstein, even about Da Vinci.
Yeah.
People, let's say, like...
Not many people, though.
Well,
not so many. Maybe one.
Maybe Walter Isaacson.
maybe one